So how do you handle, life, all the complexities, the amazing highs, the really tough lows, those moments that just sideswipe you completely, times when you just wish desperately for some kind of guide, someone wise to help you through the really tangled parts.
That's a feeling I think everyone recognizes, isn't it? That deep longing. And today, well, we're doing a deep dive into a really profound book by Chris Maxwell, Things We've Handed Down.
It's quite something.
It is. And it's not just a collection of his thoughts. Maxwell actually calls it a living three-way conversation.
Which is such a great description. It's like this ongoing dialogue between Maxwell, you listening right now, and a dozen really key thinkers he's engaged with. People like C.S. Lewis, Henri Nguyen.
Frederick Buchner, Walter
Sure.
Wangerin Jr., heavy hitters.
Sure. And our goal here, our mission with this deep dive, it isn't simply to tell you what the book says. We want to really pull out the core insights from these 12 letters, sort of a shortcut maybe to understanding how you can face your own inner struggles, find real hope, real healing, and figure out what wisdom you can pass on. It's about getting to the heart of it, not just gathering more info.
And Maxwell's central message, it really acts as this kind of luminous guide. It's for anyone wrestling with life, really, whether you're dealing with the challenges of youth or the messiness of adulthood.
Or even the uncertainties that come later in life.
It speaks directly to you wherever you happen to be on that path, inviting you to really grapple with these big ideas.
Okay, so let's unpack the core of this book. It's described as a heartfelt and insightful collection of wisdom distilled from a lifetime of experiences and encounters. What really jumped out at me was its boldness.
It's courage, yeah.
Maxwell boldly breaks the taboo, tackling stuff like sorrow and disappointment, the very things we tend to airbrush out of our social media feeds, or even just like normal conversations.
We avoid them, don't we?
Totally. But he doesn't. He leans in, offering real wisdom that comes from, as he puts it, deep reading and deep living.
And what adds another layer, I think, is that Maxwell, writing this in his 60s, he's deliberately thinking about legacy. He sees this book as a legacy of love and wisdom that will be cherished for generations.
Right.
He's looking at how society sometimes, well, looks down on aging.
Right.
And he felt this real pull to record the 12 most important life lessons he wanted to hand down. He got some inspiration from Frederick Buettner's idea of peculiar treasures.
Ah, tell me more about that.
Well, Buettner's thought is that God sees people with all our baggage, our worries, wounds, and terrible mistakes, not as rejects, but as peculiar treasures.
Wow, that really flips the script, doesn't it? The idea that your struggles, your mistakes aren't things to be ashamed of, but maybe the very things that make you uniquely valuable, cherished even.
Exactly. And Maxwell writes these letters almost like they're his last words on the subject, as if it were my final collection of reflections. And they're specifically for you, for those who are laboring to endure this thing called life.
He wants to help you grasp that truth better than you ever have before. It feels very personal, like he's sitting right there with you.
It does. It's intimate.
Okay, so let's get into navigating those storms life throws at us. Maxwell dives right into disappointment, starting with a whole chapter called Disappointment with God. That's pretty direct.
It really is. He brings in Philip Yancey's point that, some people lose their faith because of a sharp sense of disappointment with God. He doesn't skirt around it.
And he actually validates grief, saying crying is a needed experience, calling it a healthy encounter, even the therapy of tears.
And the book gets specific about the kinds of disappointments people face. Things like the death of loved ones, he shares about a pastor friend whose daughter died, a student whose brother took his own life.
So tragic.
And then there's addiction, really difficult family situations, maybe a narcissistic mother, an absent father, abuse history, plus, job loss, broken trust, dreams that don't pan out, just feeling completely stuck.
These are the real painful experiences so many people carry, often silently.
And it's widespread. The book mentions some pretty sobering statistics, too, about child abuse, fatherlessness, the foster care crisis, substance abuse among young people, online dangers, trafficking, eating disorders. It just highlights how pervasive this kind of pain and disappointment really is in our culture today.
It's a heavy reality. So, what's the way through? What's Maxwell's advice?
Well, his approach is actually quite grounded. He suggests things like journaling your feelings, praying, and crucially, talking to the right people.
Finding that safe connection.
Exactly. And he offers this reassurance. God is not intimidated by your disappointment. He understands it. The idea isn't to suppress the pain, but to bring it out, to share it.
That reminds me of that Walter Wangerin Jr. quote.
Oh, the one about joy and sorrow. It's terrible.
Yeah. The difference between shallow happiness and a deep, sustaining joy is sorrow. Joy, by the grace of God, is the transfiguration of suffering into endurance, and of endurance into character, and of character into hope.
It's about a joy that's forged through hardship, not in spite of it. A much deeper, more resilient kind of joy.
Okay, this leads into something really fascinating, a kind of paradigm shift. The idea that wounds are where light enters. This isn't just about surviving wounds. It's the idea that they're not just scars, but like openings for hope and understanding to get in. He says, welcome the darkness, the light, the life, the day.
It's quite radical, isn't it? And Barbara Brown Taylor puts it beautifully. She writes, I have learned things in the dark that I could never have learned in the light. I need darkness as much as I need light.
Wow.
And she adds, there is a light that shines in the darkness, which is only visible there. So for you listening, what if those painful parts of your story aren't just dead ends?
What if they're actually preparing you for something?
Exactly. Preparing you for a unique kind of strength, mm-hmm. a wisdom you couldn't get any other way. Think about the story of Jacob wrestling the angel. He limped forever for the blessing that follows the wound. The struggle changed him, marked him, but also blessed him.
That makes so much sense. But it sounds lonely. Who helps us when we're in that dark, wounded place?
Well, Maxwell stresses we need community. We need a fellow traveler, a mentor, a pastor. And he points to Jesus as the listener, drawing on Leonard Sweet, saying, Jesus hears us still and responds with compassion.
I was really struck by that story he tells about Skylar Vanderwilt's mother.
Oh, with the foster brother, yes.
Holding him while he's thrashing out, just whispering, you're safe, you're loved, I'm not going anywhere. That image of just steadfast presence in the middle of raw pain, that's light entering, isn't it? Just showing up.
Absolutely. And it flows perfectly into Henri Nouwen's concept of the wounded healer.
Oh, yes.
Which isn't just about empathy, but about how your own suffering actually equips you to connect and heal others. Nguyen asks, who can take away suffering without entering it?
Meaning you have to know it firsthand.
You have to know wounds intimately, yes. Experientially. Yeah. And Brennan Manning adds to this with his idea of the furious longing of God. He clarifies God isn't furious at us.
But furiously pursuing us.
Exactly. With this wild, unrestricted, ambitious, determined, gentle love, this wounded healer, God comes towards us, holds us, heals us, drawing from that deep well of understanding that comes from shared suffering.
Okay, so we've talked about disappointment and wounds. What are the essential tools Maxwell says we need for this journey?
He focuses on three key things: love, acceptance, and forgiveness. He calls them ingredients we all cherish and need, both to receive for ourselves and crucially to offer to others.
Ingredients, I like that.
He uses Jesus's analogy of the detour and the narrow gate. The idea is that the worthwhile path, the right and long way, includes extra turns, bumpy roads, and holes.
It's not the easy, straight road.
No. And it's on that harder road that a life shaped by love, acceptance, and forgiveness is really built. He shares personal examples, grandfathers, friends, his parents' people, who showed him how to receive and give these gifts.
And the forgiveness part seems key. He says, people will disappoint you and fail you. They need the assurance of your forgiveness, a forgiveness with no bitter aftertaste.
That's a high bar, isn't it? Forgiveness without bitterness.
Yeah.
But it's essential. And maybe extending that forgiveness to others helps us accept ourselves more fully, too.
That makes sense. And speaking of paths, he talks about finding perspective, drawing on Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek.
Ah, yes, a classic, inspiring us to behold the world with new eyes, to find the marvels hidden in the ordinary.
Dillard's line, how we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. That really lands.
It does. It's a call to slow down, pay attention, and find your Tinker Creek, your own personal place for rest, reflection, maybe even awe, right in the middle of everything else.
It's about being intentional. I love that he points out even Jesus snuck away toward the creek, toward the silence, toward the Father, despite his demanding life. It models that need for quiet connection.
Absolutely. And then there's Calvin Miller's idea from Life is Mostly Edges. He says, where we stumble is the place we dig for gold. Where we trip is where the treasure lies.
So the uncomfortable parts, the edges like cold, disability, uncertainty, they aren't just problems.
According to Miller, no. They're actually the places where growth and wisdom happen. We shouldn't try to avoid them, but lean into them.
That really challenges our tendency towards comfort, doesn't it?
It does. Miller critiques what he calls hurried Christianity, urging us to embrace the slowness needed for the pursuit of the depths of God. Resist the rush.
Which connects, I think, to C.S. Lewis and Surprised by Joy, the idea that joy isn't just about everything going perfectly.
Exactly. Lewis believed life is not either or, it's both and. You have answers and questions, smiles with tears, locked doors alongside open ones. Real peace and joy, Lewis argues, don't depend on our circumstances.
Yeah. They come from the giver of peace, even when things are objectively bad, like when the disciples were behind locked doors.
Precisely. Lewis even said, joy is the serious business of heaven. It's not frivolous, it's deep. And it coexists with hardship, like Ecclesiastes says, a time to weep and a time to laugh.
A serious business, I like that. Now, shifting slightly, there's the art of being you, where God is presented as the ultimate artist.
Yeah, constantly crafting and recreating us. Maxwell tells the story of Michaela Hudson, who went through terrible grief, failed academically.
And ended up finding her calling as a grief counselor.
Right, using her own deep wounds to help heal others. It's a perfect illustration of God as an artist, bringing beauty and purpose out of brokenness.
He also uses that interesting napkin analogy.
Mm-hmm. Suggesting that our deep down desire for security, for cleanliness, for things to be right, it actually points us toward God, the person who never leaves you and never runs out, who washes you clean.
Recognizing that our deepest longings are ultimately spiritual.
Exactly. Which leads naturally to embracing Psalm 139, search me, God, and know my heart, and lead me in the way everlasting. It's about trusting the artist who created you, fearfully and wonderfully made. Yep, that's you.
That self-acceptance feels crucial for hope. And then he talks about hope directly in Hope Has Its Reasons, What Fosters Hope.
Community. Connection. He shares stories like Ray Michaud, who is just a constant source of hope through prayer and service, and Warren May.
The man who survived a shooting and lost his voice.
Yes. He found healing through art and nature. His advice was incredible. If you can't say it, write it down. If you can't write it down, draw a picture. Finding alternative ways to express and process.
Such resilience. It makes me think of that Gordon Livingston quote about happiness taking time.
Oh, yeah. Virtually all the happiness-producing processes in our lives take time. This is why patience and determination are among life's primary virtues. And Livingston adds, hope is a primary virtue, too. It's about the long haul.
Right. Which brings us to the path forward, endurance, deep connection. After facing disappointment and wounds, how do we keep going? He uses a baseball analogy in Wishful Thinking.
From A. Bartley Giamatti, yeah. Baseball is designed to break your heart, Giamatti said. Yet that wishful thinking, that optimism, keeps us engaged.
It's about loving the game itself, the journey, not just the final score.
Exactly. And that kind of determined hope, that's what helps us find our purpose. It connects to Frederick Buettner's idea, finding where your deep gladness meets the world's deep hunger.
That place you're uniquely called to.
Right. And you often find that place through enduring the disappointments, through the messy, nonlinear process of grief like Kubler-Ross described. Maxwell even talks about a kind of death where the heart keeps beating, but the personality changes due to hardship.
Wow.
And in those incredibly hard times, what's needed is simple, real community, just being there.
That's powerful. And speaking of deep engagement, he explores poetry and Why I Wake Early, not just reading it, but seeing it as therapy.
As an invitation to slow down, to engage more deeply. Eugene Peterson's thoughts on poetry are key here. Peterson said poetry requires rereading. It creates white space for silence. It pushes us to ponder, to listen.
He saw it as being at the core of the life of faith, like training wheels for paying attention.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, there's science behind it too. Reading poetry apparently activates parts of the brain linked to introspection, helps memory, and can be really comforting during stress or grief.
Who knew?
Right? And the poet Lucy Shaw says poets speak into a culture that finds it hard to listen. They bear the burden of calling some aspect of reality to our attention. Maybe, for you listening, engaging with poetry could be a way to tune in differently.
A way to hear the quieter truths. Okay, this leads us to the final letter, the capstone. A long obedience in the same direction. Named after Peterson's famous book.
It's a direct challenge to our instant society, isn't it? A call to cultivate patience, virtue, endurance, instead of always seeking the quick fix.
We're so wired for instant results.
We are. Maxwell quotes Dr. Bob Moorhead on the paradoxes. Taller buildings, but shorter tempers. And Sherry Turkle's observation about technology, how texting keeps people not too close, not too far, but at just the right distance.
An illusion of connection.
Often, yes. Maxwell argues that real growth, real relationships, they just take time and consistent effort. It's about valuing the journey, the endurance itself. He gives practical advice, too. pray, plan for setbacks, get sleep, exercise, learn to say no and yes wisely, talk to good people, schedule what matters.
The nuts and bolts of sticking with it.
Exactly. The daily actions that make up that long obedience.
And he really emphasizes pastoral prayer here, but defined as humble, present, listening leadership.
Yes, it's about that authentic presence.
Right.
Which culminates beautifully in that anecdote from the TV show NCIS.
Oh, right, where they just sit together after something hard.
Yeah, no words, just together, sitting beside each other. That, Maxwell suggests, is the heart of enduring the long run of life. Just being present with God and with true friends, that quiet companionship.
That's incredibly moving. What a rich exploration of Maxwell's wisdom. This deep dive, like the letters themselves, it really feels like receiving a kind of peculiar treasure.
It does.
It's about learning to live with real joy, real purpose, real peace, even with disappointment and wounds. Maybe not in spite of them, but almost because of them.
I think that's right. It's an invitation, isn't it?
Yeah.
To seek deeper connections, allow yourself to heal, and think about what you want to pass on. Maybe find your own Tinker Creek. Try reading some poetry.
Commit to that long obedience. What's one small step you, listening right now, could take today toward one of these ideas?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we can leave you with this final thought inspired by Drew Dyke. At the end of your life, you won't be worried about how successful you were or how much money you made. The micro stories will matter. You'll remember who you invested in and who invested in you. You'll be glad you showed up.
It really comes down to presence, doesn't it?
It does. The ultimate legacy isn't what you get, but what you give, what you hand down through love and just showing up.
Mm.
So the question is, what will you hand down?